Welcome to this Forthright Radio for July 15th, 2020. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. Quote, American plutocracy wants what majorities won't provide. Right-wing populism decries changes it can't stop. The Republican Party's rhetoric conjures up a mythical past because the party, as it is currently constituted, cannot survive in a democratic future. The GOP has turned to a polarizing and counter-majoritarian strategy precisely because it knows it is in a race against time. The forces of reaction cannot win forever in a reasonably open and competitive political system. But this very fact endangers that open and competitive system. End of the quote. These are words from Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality, one of whose authors is our guest today, Paul Pearson. It's just been released by Live Right Publishing. Paul Pearson is the John Gross Professor of Political Science at UC Berkeley. Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality, is one of several books he has written with Jacob Hacker, who is the director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies and a political science professor at Yale University. Their other books include American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, Off Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. Professor Pearson has also written many other books, including the prize-winning Dismantling the Welfare State, Reagan, Thatcher, and the Politics of Retrenchment. And with that, by way of introduction, we welcome you to Forthright Radio, Professor Paul Pearson.
Thanks so much for having me on, Joy.
Well, thank you for joining us. In your new book, Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality, you and your co-author, Jacob Hacker, describe the coming together of plutocracy and right-wing populism, calling it plutocratic populism. Please explain what you mean by these terms and be very basic about it, because terms like left, right, center, extreme right, extreme left get tossed around and we seldom define what they mean exactly.
Sure, I appreciate that. I think it is important just to be clear right from the outset. And probably the main term there that needs clarifying is plutocrat or plutocracy, by which we really mean broadly rule by the rich. And in the U.S., you know, over the last 40 years, there's been this incredible shift in the distribution of income and wealth towards the top 1%, really towards the top 10th of 1% or 100th of 1%. And it's just a stunning transformation that really has no equal or even close parallel in other rich democracies, which have not gotten all that much more unequal. And with that growing inequality of income and wealth has come a growing inequality of power, a growing ability of the wealthy and major corporations to push their weight around in the corridors of power. And what we argue in the book is that the main way in which this is being done in contemporary American politics is through the Republican Party and through this alliance that plutocrats have built with populists who are pretty well represented, at least symbolically, though not in terms of what he does, by Donald Trump.
Now, is this a book about Donald Trump? Since Let Them Eat Tweets is the title.
Right. Well, the first sentence is, this is not a book about Donald Trump. And it's a book about developments in American society and American politics that made Donald Trump possible, which we also think are important to focus on, not just because we need to understand the history, though we think the history is stunning and worth exploring for its own rights. But if we don't understand how we got here and the kinds of structures and forces that put somebody like Donald Trump in the White House and have supported him while he's been in the White House, we're not going to be able to understand what needs to change in American politics to move us forward. So it's really an attempt, and we play around with tweets because one of the things that we emphasize in the book is that a lot of the way that this alliance works is by distracting people, by making them focus on some dimensions of politics and some threats and ignore others that are really fundamental to their well-being. And if we don't really zero in on those things, we're unlikely to be able to make the kinds of changes, regardless of who wins the election in November, we're unlikely to be making the kinds of changes that would get us on a better course.
You note that there are usually two narratives generally offered for our current political situation. The first is that of a Republican civil war, and the second is focused on racism. Now, you say, although they each have some elements of truth to them, they're incomplete. Please explain your thinking about this.
Sure. Well, maybe we start with the first narrative, which we're actually more critical of. And the way that people often tell the story of Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party is that there was a clash between him and the establishment, or between these rising populists and the establishment, which was closer to corporate America and to the interests of the wealthy. And maybe you could take somebody like Paul Ryan, who was Speaker of the House when Trump became president and who was Romney's running mate in 2012, take him as representative of that establishment group. And the argument that is sometimes made is that, well, Trump defeated those forces, that there was a clash between these two wings of the party, a civil war in the party, and that Trump emerged victorious. And the problem with that narrative is that it suggests that these establishment interests, most importantly, the wealthy and corporate America, which large parts of which have aligned pretty closely with the Republican Party, or something like the Koch network, the Koch brothers, multi-billionaires who have work to try to push the Republican Party in the direction of deregulating the state and cutting taxes, suggesting is that these forces lost a civil war. And in the book, we have a chapter about this that we call A Very Civil War. And our point is that the plutocrats and corporate America actually did fantastically well out of Trump's first term. Mitch McConnell, who's clearly a representative of these establishment forces, that the leader of Republicans in the Senate, described Trump's first year as the best year for conservatives in McConnell's lifetime. And Charles Koch, who's the leader of the Koch network now that his brother David has died, also said that they'd accomplished more in the last 5 years than in the previous 30 years that he'd been working in politics. So the very civil war that's gone on has seeded a really important role to Trump and to these populist forces, but that's only been possible, we suggest, because these so-called populists have delivered big time for the powerful establishment interests associated with plutocracy. Huge tax cuts, a gutting of federal regulations, and Supreme Court justices who the business community loves, and lots of other court appointments as well. It's been a hugely successful few years for the plutocrats.
One of the themes of your book is the seeming contradiction between the self-interests of people who support populism, the little guy, let's call them, versus the plutocrats. And you talk about what you call the conservative dilemma. Talk about that and how, of course, that's what your whole book is about, is how did they actually convince people in very different economic situations with very different economic interests to go along with this. So what is this conservative dilemma?
You're really now getting, I think, to the core issues of the book. And just to frame it for a second, the Trump tax cuts of 2017, $2 trillion, the likely long-term cost of those tax cuts, 80% of the permanent benefits from those tax cuts go to the top 1% of the income distribution. This is just a massive piece of legislation that will have consequences for decades in the possibilities of government helping ordinary citizens. So how is it possible for a populist administration to do something like that? And that's really the core issue in the book. And we do summarize the questions as evolving around what we call the conservative dilemma, which is the challenge that a conservative party like the Republican Party faces in an environment where there's a lot of inequality. There are some haves and then a lot of have-nots. But you have to win elections. You have to win the votes of a lot of people who are have-nots. And this challenge is as old as democracy. And it runs especially powerfully through conservative parties because they tend to be the parties that are most closely aligned with economic elites. So they face this challenge what do they do about the fact that they're really tightly connected to these economic elites and want to protect them, but they have to reach out to ordinary voters? And what we suggest is there are basically two ways that a conservative party can go. It can moderate. It can moderate and move in the direction of trying to be less responsive to those elites and more responsive to ordinary citizens around economic issues that most voters really care about. Or it can shift in the direction of trying to make the main divides in politics about things other than economics, about cultural divides, whether those be based on things like immigration or religion or geographic divides, or frequently divides along racial or ethnic lines. And what we've suggested is that as inequality grows, as it has in the United States over the last 30 years, this dilemma just becomes more and more intense. And what we've seen in the U.S., and this has been true in other countries at other times, you see a similar kind of dynamic. What's happened in the U.S. is that the Republican Party has increasingly intensified the cultural divides in American politics as a way of shifting attention and gaining support from voters around those kinds of issues while it protects the plutocrats.
That brings up what you write about identity politics, which is a double-edged sword. You note that there are three R's. What are they, and how does plutocratic populism utilize identity to further their aims?
So one of the critical questions that we're trying to get in the book is this issue of why do voters support a government and a party that is really not pursuing economic policies that are beneficial to them or that they perceive as being beneficial to them in most cases? And what we suggest is that it does involve this process in which the party and its most powerful supporters try to focus attention on other aspects of political and social life and to build support and mobilize voters around those concerns. And so the three R's that we talk about are resentment, racialization, and rigging. Resentment is essentially just trying to make people angry about other things and to make people feel like the targets of their anger are something other than the plutocrats and something other than Republican politicians who might be pursuing policies that are actually damaging for people. So the whole, what we talked about in an earlier book is as a long-term assault on government, on the role of government, and to turn government into something that many conservative voters in particular see as a vehicle for taxing them and giving that money to other folks who are not deserving, is a central part of this dynamic. And of course, closely associated with that is the second R, which is racialization, right? Which is to make as much as possible, and sometimes this is done through sort of dog whistles, it's done implicitly, but not explicitly, and more recently it's done. Certainly Donald Trump has given up the dog whistle and reached for something a lot louder and a lot clearer than that in talking about racialization. But the basic idea is that a lot of that anger should be directed towards minorities who are asking for something for nothing. Two things go together quite tightly. And then the third, which I think has emerged most recently, but is something that we see as a really serious issue increasingly of concern in the U.S., is using what political power you have to actually change the makeup of the electorate or to change the ability of voters who are opposed to you to actually have any influence over the political process and what government does. So gerrymandering, right, restructuring the lines of congressional districts or legislative districts in the states. Wisconsin's a really striking example of this, where Democrats can win the majority of the vote for the state legislature statewide and end up with something just a little bit more than a third of the seats in the state legislature because the gerrymandering has been so successful. Voter suppression is another aspect of vote rigging, where you just try to make it more and more difficult for your political opponents to vote.
We are in a situation now with this COVID-19 pandemic and uprisings all over the entire country that are sustained against racism. What effect do you think that's going to be having and having now. I mean, we're seeing things like the Confederate flag is taken off the Mississippi State flag. The Washington football team is finally changing their name. We don't know what to yet, but the R word will no longer be it. Statues are coming down all over. We're in a very unusual time. What do you have to say about this particular change that we're going through?
As you say, Joy, it's really, this is an astonishing period. I don't think there's any question that we are living through a world historical moment for the globe, but certainly for the United States. And it's multidimensional. I think it would take us some time to work through the different pieces of it, because, of course, you've got a massive public health crisis, astonishing public health crisis. You've got the incredible economic strains that are likely to be persistent connected with that public health emergency. And then you have this remarkable, really remarkable wave of social protest around, primarily around issues of race and racial inequality that have been sweeping across the U.S. and, by some estimates, involved the largest public demonstrations in American history. All of these are huge changes. They intersect with each other in complicated ways. It's very, very difficult for us to predict where all of this is heading. But just to focus on the social protests, as you were asking, I do think this is a really stunning development. And what's striking to me about it is that as much as the president seems to want to imagine that he's Richard Nixon and that we're reliving 1968, and that he can invoke the theme of law and order and win a presidential election by presenting himself as the law and order candidate, it does not look like it is playing out that way at all, at least so far. I think there are a number of big reasons why that's the case. One is simply the demographics of the country have shifted dramatically, right, since 1968. In 1968, something like 80% of the American population was whites who did not have a college degree. Now that's about 60% of the U.S. population. That makes a big, big difference. And this broader demographic change is a very important part of the dynamics of plutocratic populism. We may want to come back to that. So just that demographic difference, I think, makes a huge difference. And I also think what's striking is that whereas the social protest that took place in the 1960s, I mean, there was some multiracial element to it, but it was mostly African-Americans who were central to those protests. And what we see going on now is a much more genuinely multiracial movement. And you can see in public opinion polls, there is broad sympathy among whites. I mean, whites are divided about this, partly along the line between Trump supporters and non-Trump supporters, between more rural America and urban and suburban America, but an awful lot of white Americans, particularly those with college educations and those living in urban areas or suburban areas, have large amounts of sympathy for Black Lives Matter. So, right, so that makes a big difference in the way that this plays out. Trump is finding himself on the short end. You know, when he talks about Confederate flags, he's on the short end of public opinion and on many of these issues having to do with the protests. And then, of course, the last big difference between now and 1968 was that Richard Nixon was running against the Democrats who were in the White House at that point, but Donald Trump is in the White House now. So for him to say, when he's president, you need to vote for me to maintain order, that's a lot less convincing, because this is all happening on his watch and happening in significant part in reaction to who he is and how he expresses himself in the White House. Obviously, that's not the only thing by any means that's going on, but I just think the politics of it are very, very different than the politics of 50 years ago.
We're speaking with Professor Paul Pearson. His book is Let Them Eat Tweets: How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality. Let's stay on the comparison with Nixon for a little bit longer. Your take on Nixon is more nuanced than many. You note that he was left on the economy and the environment and right on race. We've already talked about the race part. But today, President Trump is going to be announcing some pretty radical changes to the National Environmental Policy Act, which was one of the things that Nixon allowed to happen. Expand on those kind of differences. It's shocking to me to look back on the Nixon era with anything like fondness, but frankly, there were aspects that I wish we still had.
Yeah, well, I'm not suggesting that you should do that, but we do think that the differences, both the similarities and the differences between Nixon and the contemporary Republican Party are striking. So Nixon is often seen as kind of the originator of what's sometimes called the Southern Strategy, right? This plan that you are going to basically use to backlash among whites and especially among Southern whites to the civil rights movement as a way to build up the Republican Party and gain support. And you do that through dog whistles, and you do that through talking about law and order and so on. And Nixon absolutely did that. But at the same time, he believed very strongly that for Republicans to be able to compete, Jacob and I came across in doing the work on this book, an old memo by Lee Atwater, who was one of the political strategists of this kind of this Southern strategy. He wrote it a little bit later than Nixon, but he wrote it for Reagan. But it basically outlines the idea that if you want to appeal to those voters, if you're trying to appeal to white working class voters, many of whom had traditionally voted for the Democrats, you can use these racial appeals, and you should use these racial appeals, they argue, but you also need to make sure that economically you really are a populist, that you're doing something for these people. And so Nixon, because that's where they were on economics, they wanted help from the government, they wanted the support of government, and they didn't want a government that was just going to back business and economic elites. And Nixon did that. Nixon, on economic issues, he would look way left of center in most respects. He advocated a universal health care plan. He oversaw a big, big expansion of Social Security. He palled around with union leaders. He thought it was very important to cultivate George Meany, who was the head of the AFL-CIO. He positioned himself very differently on these economic issues as a way of trying to gain voter support. And what the path that we chart, you know, over the course of the book is how the Republican Party gradually shifts. And then as inequality grows and the power of the wealthy and the power of corporations grows, that Republicans essentially drop all those economic policies and move towards a policy where their top priority always is cutting taxes for wealthy people and cutting taxes for corporations. And in order to make that work politically, what we suggest is they've had to find ways to constantly amp up the cultural issues and make people feel like their way of life is threatened by the Republicans' opponents.
You talk about Newt Gingrich and his revolution. Someone was quoted recently saying that Newt Gingrich was Trump before Trump. Remind our listeners, maybe some of whom weren't even born, when he just turned Washington, D.C. upside down, and explain the ramifications of that.
Yeah, I think Newt Gingrich is in many ways a pivotal figure and really revealing, right? So in 1990, George W. Bush's father, Herbert Walker Bush, is in the White House, and he's a kind of traditional Republican, right of center, but not all that far right of center, and willing to do bipartisan deals on big legislation, expanding the Clean Air Act, passing the Americans with Disabilities Act, reaching a budget deal, a deficit reduction bill that involved big increases in taxes on high income groups, which is something that, you know, Republicans now would never do. And Gingrich was in the House at this point and essentially led a rebellion against the sitting Republican president after Bush raises taxes in 1990. And he leads this rebellion and basically says, we're not going to be that kind of party. We're not going to cooperate with the Democrats. We're going to burn the House down, basically. And we're going to come to power by making people hate the Democrats, by making them hate Washington. And he was very successful in doing that and in building this new, much more intense, more extreme a more fear-mongering kind of Republican Party that was quite successful, that drew on the strength of things like talk radio and the National Rifle Association and the growing power of evangelicals, organized evangelicals, and so on. Then it's critical, just a last thing to mention about Gingrich, who I do think just did play a central role in originating the modern Republican Party, is that he wasn't just a bomb thrower. He was also a rainmaker. He was very much saw the opportunities for financing the new Republican Party by cutting deals with wealthy Americans and with corporate America, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, where the deals would go, you know, essentially where we will give you a lot of what you want from government. We will cut your taxes. We will get rid of regulations. We will get you judges who are going to favor business. But in return for that, you need to support us, and you need to support us generously. So Gingrich and some of his allies, including people like John Boehner, who, you know, would much later become Speaker of the House, were there at the birth of this alliance of plutocrats and populists.
Julian Zelizer has a new book coming out, and that was the quote that Gingrich was Trump before Trump. He says that Trump was considering Gingrich for vice president, but that Gingrich bowed out, saying something along the lines of, Trump's a pirate, I'm a pirate. It wouldn't be good to have two pirates on the ticket. And he deferred to Mike Pence. Well, it's a funny story, et cetera, with a lot of truth to it. That brings up Mike Pence and his role in all this. Please expand on that.
I haven't had a chance to read Julian's book yet, but he's a terrific historian, and I'm sure it's fascinating, and I think it is a really good time to remember who Newt Gingrich was. And astonishingly, even after Gingrich eventually was removed as Speaker, underwent a series of scandals and debacles and had to resign sort of in humiliation. So that was, you know, that was back in the late 90s. So it's astonishing that he's still around and prominent in Republican circles so much later. But yeah, Mike Pence, who joins the ticket, he was actually really struggling, losing popularity as governor in Indiana. And so hooked his wagon to Donald Trump. And it's a reminder at the time when this was happening in the summer of 2016 that most people, myself, I've got to say included, were highly doubtful of the chances that Trump would actually win the election. So Pence, in some ways, was jumping because he was already in a really difficult situation, was not very popular as the governor of Indiana because he pursued pretty extreme right policies. But he comes on board and occupies a really critical position because, in a lot of ways, he really embodies this plutocratic populist structure that has become central to the Republican Party. And, you know, most people, they know the populist side of that, the strong evangelical side, because that's what Pence puts front and center in the way that he presents himself. But he's been a long-term ally of leading plutocrats and the Koch brothers in particular. He's extremely right-wing on economic issues. And he occupies this really key position in the administration because Trump, who's not really interested at all in policy and governance or personnel, except as long as people are loyal to him, he puts Pence in charge of the process of filling the administration. And as we document in the book, Pence puts in a ton of people who have really, really strong connections to the Koch network. And Pence is a long time number one, currently his chief of staff, though he's held other positions in and around the administration. Mark Short had a long stint working directly for a key organization of the Koch brothers. So Pence really carries the interests of the plutocrats and people tightly connected to the plutocrats right into the Trump administration.
Creeping counter-majoritarianism. I love that term I hadn't heard that before. Anyway, creeping counter-majoritarianism, you say, exploits long-standing features in the American political system. And you note three in particular: territorially grounded elections, that is, a decentralized electoral administration, the Senate, and our supposed three branches, checks and balances. Talk about these.
Yeah, this is a really important and troubling development. We do think, and you started with the passage, which is from the conclusion of the book, I think, that this plutocratic populist agenda is running out of time because the demographics of the country, as we're seeing, are turning against it. Lindsey Graham, senator from South Carolina, who was a harsh critic of Donald Trump, but then turned into a cheerleader for Donald Trump. At one point earlier, he said, look, you know, we're just not generating enough angry old white guys for the Republican Party to stay in business. And that's true. But that also creates some real dangers because, as we argue in the book, when conservative parties find that they're having more and more trouble competing in elections, that can make them skeptical of core institutions of democracy. And so one possible threat, and it's the kind that Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt have explored in their wonderful book, How Democracies Die, is what you call sort of creeping authoritarianism, where you sort of you gradually slide into an authoritarian system. And we've seen that happen in a bunch of countries recently. It's happened in Hungary. It's arguably happening in Poland, where a right-wing populist just won re-election to the presidency. It's happened in Turkey. And people worry about the possibility of that happening here. And I think there's good reason to worry that's a possibility. But the other possibility that really is made possible by American institutions is that you move towards a system in which a party that commands a minority of the vote can actually nonetheless control the key levers of political power. Largely, it's because of these kind of unusual territorial features of how we run elections in the United States, which all bias things towards the party whose base is in more rural areas, which in American politics means the Republican Party. Now, that's most obviously true in the Senate, where it's possible for 20% of the American population to choose 50% of the senators, which is really just astonishing. And if you think, just to make this really concrete, when Justice Kavanaugh won his vote in the Senate to join the Supreme Court, which he got a narrow majority in the Senate, but the senators who voted for him had only gotten 44% of the votes in the Senate elections that chose those 100 senators, right? The Democrats who voted against his nomination had gotten 56% of the vote, right? But they didn't have a majority in the Senate, so they couldn't stop that nomination. So this is very clear in the Senate. It's an issue in the Electoral College, as we saw, where Donald Trump won even though he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton. And it's even an issue in the House in ways that are a little bit more complicated, but basically result from the fact that Democrats, because they're strong in cities, a lot more of their votes are wasted. So Republicans can often get a majority in the House of Representatives, even though they haven't won a majority of the vote for the House of Representatives. It's really quite striking. It runs through all these institutions. What we suggest in the book is that Republicans can take that basic advantage and just push it harder and harder by making the Senate more obstructionist, by packing the Supreme Court. It's an astonishing thing. Republicans have lost a popular vote in 6 out of the last 7 presidential elections, but they have a majority on the Supreme Court, right? And they can use that majority to further entrench their power by, you know, making decisions like Citizens United that allow huge amounts of dark money to flow into American politics, by gutting the Voting Rights Act, which allows voting suppression to be carried on in the states, by going after labor unions, which are a key constituency for the Democratic Party. There are just a lot of ways in which a party that finds it harder and harder to command a majority of the vote in the country can nonetheless really entrench its power.
Paul Pearson, what do you suggest to resolve that reality?
Well, so that's a big question, and I'm hesitant about making any kind of predictions, especially now, because I do think we're in a really volatile environment. But we talk about this at the end of the book, and essentially the argument that we make, which I would say is a hopeful argument, I'm not sure that I would say it's an optimistic argument, because I worry deeply, and Jacob worries deeply, about whether our political system can handle the kinds of tensions that we describe. But the hopeful story essentially would say, look, this strategy is running out of time. The strategy of plutocratic populism is running out of time because the demography of the country is changing radically. And in some ways, as we were talking about before, Donald Trump is actually accelerating that transformation because he's alienating lots of white voters in the suburbs, and especially those with more education, especially women. And potentially that's just accelerating the push away from this kind of politics. And so we suggest in the book that probably the first thing that needs to happen, really, to stop the developments that we describe is a big electoral defeat for the Republican Party that will convince them that they need to change direction. And that certainly looks possible right now. But then the other part of the argument that we make, and the people who like that first argument aren't going to like the second one. People who don't like that the argument that I just described might like the second one more. But we argue that in the long run, the health of American democracy really does depend upon there being a healthy conservative party. We don't think there is. We have a healthy conservative party right now. But we think that American institutions are designed to have a two-party system. We're likely to continue to have a two-party system. One of those parties is going to be more conservative. And so the real question is not whether you can get rid of the conservative dilemma or get rid of conservative politics. It's whether you can have a conservative politics that is more constructive, that doesn't use racial divisions as a foundational basis for its way of mobilizing people into politics. And we do think that's possible, and that, in fact, if we can just keep the electoral process going through this election and for a few more, that the Republican Party will be forced to move in a direction of really fashioning appeals that are broader and that are not so tightly connected to the interests of plutocrats. And you can see in some states, there are some states, they tend to be blue states, right? States where politicians, if they want to be successful, they need to be more moderate. You see people like Larry Hogan in Maryland or Charlie Baker in Massachusetts who are popular and pretty successful, but they really present a very different face of the Republican Party.
Can you go into that aspect of your assertion that these trends are actually bad for capitalism and bad for conservatism? Why do you say that?
I mean, look at what's going on in the United States right now with this public health crisis. None of this is good for the American economy, right? And so having a government that is not really a government, right, that has so bought into identity politics and the mobilization of fear and threat and has systematically run down the capacities of government, this turns out to be a disaster for the economy. I mean, the book that we wrote before Let Them Eat Tweets, which is called American Amnesia, really focuses on this part of the story, in which we say that American capitalists in some ways have become so powerful that it's bad for American capitalism, right? It's good for their bank accounts, right? And maybe for some narrow set of stockholders in the short run. But if you don't have a decent education system and you don't have a decent healthcare system and you don't make investments in the future, you don't make investments in basic public infrastructure, that's terrible for the economy and for American capitalism in the long run. And we argued in that book that when the American economy was most successful, and it was enormously successful in the post-war period, it was based on a mixed economy in which many members of the business community recognized, and if they didn't recognize, they were forced to deal with it by voters and by sources of countervailing power in the society, like labor unions. They recognized that things were much better if you actually did have an effective government that took on a lot of the tasks that private businesses can't take on or won't take on, right? And we're witnessing this every day now in the starkest possible fashion. If you do not have a capable federal government, you're not going to have a well-functioning economy because you can't deal with the kinds of crises that we're facing today.
Well, you call the Affordable Care Act, popularly known as Obamacare, the most redistributive federal initiative in 50 years. But even as the nation is reeling from the realities of COVID-19 with record high unemployment, record high hospitalizations and death, the Trump administration continues to pursue the overturning of the ACA. And the Supreme Court has whittled provisions down each session, most recently contraceptives. And this, as poll after poll indicates, that health care is one of the top issues for voters. So what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the Affordable Care Act, you know, and the politics around that encapsulates so much of what we're talking about in the book. It was a hugely redistributive program because it vastly expanded access to health care and reduced the cost of health care for millions, tens of millions of Americans, while extending important benefits like protection against pre-existing conditions for all Americans. But it was attacked from the outset, even though it was based on a design that Mitt Romney had supported when he was governor of Massachusetts, that was developed by right-of-center think tank. It was attacked in the most vicious terms from the outset and highly racialized in the way that Republicans went after it. And so in the debate in 2017, which, again, it's so telling about what has happened on the right in American politics, right, this effort to repeal and replace Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, would have been devastating for many of the core voting blocks for Donald Trump. It would have vastly, the legislation they designed would have vastly increased the cost of health care for older white Americans, particularly living in the South, particularly living in rural areas. You know, just shocking, like even Tucker Carlson called this out when he was interviewing Donald Trump, said, like, you know, how are you doing? How is this consistent with what you ran on? And Trump answered, well, lots of things aren't consistent. That was his answer. So why did they develop a health care plan that would be so devastating for their own voters? They did it because they wanted to generate hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that they could use, that they could free up from these programs in order to finance more tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. That is the answer, right? That is the explanation. They wanted that money so they could direct it towards the people who they really cared about. Now, it failed by John McCain, famously, as he was dying, walked up into the chamber of the Senate and cast a decisive vote against that effort to repeal Obamacare. But it came very close to passing, even though it was hugely unpopular, even among Republican voters. So it really, I think, in a lot of ways, and the fact that they would continue to pursue this agenda, slashing access to health care in the middle of a pandemic where millions of people are losing their private health insurance, it says an awful lot about their priorities.
Yes, you actually have a wonderful set of figures, one of which shows what polls indicate people want and don't want versus legislation. Share with our listeners just a few examples of those stark differences.
I'm glad you pointed that out, Joy, because I do feel like, you know, you don't want to have too many tables and figures in a book like this, but a few of them can be really telling. And basically, so this is data that was pulled together from a public opinion polling by a political scientist named Chris Warshaw. And he looked at all, like, the major pieces of legislation, really, really major pieces of legislation going back to 1990, actually to some of that legislation we're talking about before, the Clean Air Act amendments and so on, and just looked at the polling around the time that they were passed, or in the case of the health care bill we were just talking about, it just failed to pass. And just said, well, did voters support this? And there's quite a range. There's some legislation that's extremely popular, like extending the Clean Air Act, making that stronger. There's some legislation like Obamacare that gets kind of a mixed review. And then there are the two that really stand out that are super unpopular. And lo and behold, those are the Trump tax cuts and the effort to repeal and not really replace, but we'll call it repeal and replace, the Affordable Care Act. Right. So, and as Jacob and I point out, for a political scientist, these are like unicorns. Like, you really, I mean, they're bad unicorns, but like, they're things that you shouldn't see. You wouldn't expect in a democracy a government to say, okay, we're in office now. What we're going to do is we're going to pass really important legislation that people really, really don't like. That's something you shouldn't expect to see very often. And in fact, we don't see it very often. But we saw it twice in the first year of the Trump administration. And essentially, that's because those were policy initiatives that were designed to reward plutocrats, even at the expense of the Trump administration's voters. So I do think it's a picture that's worth a thousand words. It really reveals what the contemporary Republican Party has become and what its priorities are.
Okay, back to the Senate. You have some things to say about the filibuster, and it's coming up lately in the election. Biden has had some things to say about it recently. Remind our listeners what the filibuster is and what your feelings are about it.
Yeah, so the filibuster is a rule in the Senate. It's not, people sometimes write about it like it's part of the Constitution. It's been around forever, but that's not true. It's actually become, it's a rule that, in fact, the Senate has changed the rule in the recent past. It's not, you can't filibuster cabinet nominees anymore, Supreme Court nominees anymore. They could change it again. You just would need 51 votes in the Senate to change it. But it's a rule that says basically you can stop legislation from proceeding if you've got 41 votes. And it doesn't take a very high percentage of the population in the U.S., given the way the Senate is structured, to get 41 votes. And so if you want to block legislation, this is a hugely important tool. And so there is going to be a controversy coming up. It's going to be an issue that if Joe Biden wins the election and if Democrats regain control of the Senate, they're immediately going to run up against this challenge that much of what they want to do is going to be filibustered. And since they're not going to have 60 seats, they're going to face a lot of obstruction, just as Barack Obama did back in 2009 and 2010 and after. So there is going to be, I think, a discussion about whether or not that's a desirable feature of the Senate. My personal feeling is that it is so profoundly anti-democratic, and I mean anti-democratic with a small d, not anti-democratic party, though I think it plays that role too, that it shouldn't be impossible for big majorities of the country to legislate. And the filibuster can make it impossible for even positions that have a big majority of support to become law. So my personal position is that I would like to see that change, but you would have to get a very high level of consensus among Democrats for that to happen. And to be honest, even though you hear more discussion about this now, I have a hard time seeing a situation. I think the Democratic Party is just more diffuse, made up of more different factions than is true of the contemporary Republican Party. And I think many Democratic senators like the filibuster, or at least are really reluctant to get rid of it. So it's not at all clear to me. I would be surprised, in fact, if we saw Democrats get rid of the filibuster, even if they are successful in this fall's election.
And finally, Professor Pearson, you mentioned the lame duck sessions of Republican legislatures with newly elected Democratic governors in North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And just a few days ago, the Wisconsin Supreme Court upheld the Republican laws curbing powers of Democratic officials in Wisconsin. Do you have any comments on that?
Not in the details of the decision, but I think it is another indication, there are many, of the way in which Republicans have really shown their disdain in many cases for democracy, right? So you lose an election, a governor of the other party comes in, and immediately during that lame duck session, you try to gut their power, right? You don't care about the power of a governor as long as it's a governor of your party. But if the citizens of your state decide that they're going to vote for a Democrat, you're going to take that person's power away. I think that really is an expression of contempt for democracy and for the citizens of your state. And sadly, I don't think those are isolated incidents. I think we see more and more examples, not just in Wisconsin, but in North Carolina and other places.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Professor Paul Pearson. We very much appreciate your work.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Joy. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Paul Pearson, whose book with his co-author, Yale University political science professor Jacob Hacker, is Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality. It's just been released by LiveRight Publishing. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast usually each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson, I'm Joy LeClaire. And you can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media.